Imagine just for a second that you are trapped right in the middle of a massive antelope stampede.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, there's like 1,000 terrified beasts just charging past you. Dust is completely choking your lungs, hooves are flying everywhere, and you are just barely fighting for your life.
Sounds incredibly chaotic.
It is. And somehow you manage to survive. The dust finally settles. And as you're, you know, catching your breath, you notice that one of the dead antelopes on the ground is actually still breathing.
So you go to check on it.
Right. You step closer to help it, and suddenly, ooh, its rib cage just explodes outward.
Oh, gross.
Very gross. But it's not like an alien parasite that crawls out of the gore. It is a fluffy pink bunny rabbit.
Which is just so jarring.
Completely. It's slick with blood. It turns to you, opens its little mouth, and in this completely demonic, guttural voice, it just says, "Grind bones, mine."
Yeah, that is the absolute last thing your brain is prepared to process in that moment.
Exactly.
Which is, I mean, that's entirely the point of the text we are looking at today.
It really is.
Yeah.
So welcome to the deep dive. We are jumping straight into the deep end of the land of terror today.
It's quite a trick.
It really is. We have this fascinating stack of serialized narrative logs in front of us. And they follow a very specific party of fey travelers.
Right.
Our mission today is to basically unpack how this narrative masterfully weaponizes our own genre expectations against us.
Because if you read fantasy, you know the drill.
Yeah, exactly. You know what a monster is supposed to look like. You know what an enchanted forest is supposed to like feel like.
It's, the tropes are very established.
Yeah, but this story takes those concepts, completely hollows them out, and fills them with something that is hilarious, deeply unsettling, and honestly, surprisingly profound.
It really is. And to really grasp how these subversions work, we need to look at who is actually experiencing them.
The party itself.
Right. The logs focus on this wonderfully eccentric fey party. You have Lady Hannah, who is a golden hawk, which is essentially a highly skilled warrior.
Oh, very capable.
Then you have Sir Tristan, who is this notoriously stoic elf knight. Like, he gives away absolutely nothing emotionally.
Just a total blank wall of a guy.
Exactly. Then there's Minstrel Sam. He's this grizzled, cynical old bard who would clearly, you know, rather be sitting in a tavern somewhere.
Just complaining the whole time?
Oh, completely. And then arguably the most important members for actually surviving this landscape, they're magical night steeds.
Oh my gosh, I'm already obsessed with the horses in this story.
They're the best part.
They really are. Because even they defy the standard, like, noble steed trope.
Entirely. So Sir Tristan rides Sohate, who mostly plays the part of the serious, imposing war horse.
Right.
But Lady Hannah rides Princess Peaches.
Princess Peaches, I love it.
And Peaches is, well, to put it mildly, she is incredibly vain.
So vain.
She's intensely focused on her own beauty and really not particularly interested in typical knightly bravery.
Which brings us right back to that antelope stampede.
Yeah.
Because the way these horses react to the danger is, it's our first real clue that this story operates on a totally different frequency.
Yes.
So to survive the herd, the horses have to use their glamours, right? Their innate fey illusion.
Right, to protect themselves.
Yeah, and so he does exactly what you'd expect. He projects this terrifying, spike-covered, fire-snorting, nightmare illusion to terrify the antelopes into parting around him.
Classic war horse move.
Exactly. But Princess Peaches, she just uses her magic to disguise herself as a giant rock.
I love that so much. She literally just stands there impersonating a boulder.
Just letting the antelopes bounce right off her.
It is a brilliantly subtle, lazy use of fey magic.
It's so funny. But the stampede itself is really just the appetizer for the real subversion here.
Because of what caused the stampede?
Right. The logs reveal that the herd was running from a troll. But it's not a towering, club-wielding behemoth anymore.
Not at all.
Because of some previous encounter with unstable magical potions, this troll has actually been transfigured into that pink fluffy bunny I mentioned at the top of the show.
Right, the one that burst out of the chest.
Yeah. And then, as if the indignity of being a bunny wasn't enough, the bunny was apparently squashed flat by a winged pink elephant.
Which is just, it's a sequence of events so absurd that the characters themselves actually let their guard down.
I mean, I would too.
Right.
If I see a squashed bunny that was trampled by a pink elephant and 1,000 antelopes, I'm checking that off the threat list. I'm moving on.
You assume the threat is completely neutralized.
Yeah. But then we get that chest bursting scene. The antelope's chest expands way too far, detonates into this spray of entrails, and the bunny leaps out.
It's so visceral.
And it kicks Lady Hannah with its hind legs so hard that she is literally launched backward through the air like she was hit by a falling oak tree.
The physical power is just insane.
It is. But I want to pause here for a second and kind of challenge the mechanics of this scene.
Okay.
Because visually, yes, it's basically a biological Trojan horse,
yeah,
right? A monster hiding inside the ribcage of an animal.
Right.
But why wrap it in innocence? Doesn't making the monster a cute woodland creature actually, I don't know, diminish the horror of the troll?
I would actually argue it amplifies the horror exponentially.
Really? How so?
Well, what the author is doing here is weaponizing cognitive dissonance.
Okay, unpack that for me.
So think about how the human brain, or a fey warrior's brain in this case, processes danger.
Okay.
If a 15-foot troll steps out of the bushes, your brain instantly categorizes it. Large threat, lethal force required, engage, fight, or flight.
Right. You know the rules of engagement.
Precisely. The neural pathways for dealing with a giant monster are very well established, but a fluffy pink bunny.
Your brain just says, oh, cute.
Exactly. It automatically files that under safe, harmless, or cute.
Right.
So when that seemingly harmless entity violently caves in an antelope's chest and speaks with a demonic voice, it completely short-circuits their ability to assess the threat.
That makes total sense.
The juxtaposition of this extreme, brutal physical trauma with a cuddly exterior completely shatters the expected pattern.
Yeah.
It makes the violence feel so much more violating because it breached your psychological defenses before it ever even threw a punch.
Man, that is so true. And the worst part is it retains all of its original troll lethality.
Oh, absolutely.
Lady Hannah recovers from the kick, strikes it with her rapier, and manages to cleanly chop off half of the rabbit's ear.
Good hit.
But the underlying troll magic is still active. So the logs describe the stump of the ear immediately bubbling and regenerating.
Growing back in real time?
Yeah, it just grows back while the beast laughs that rumbling guttural laugh and bounds away into the deep woods.
It's terrifying. It leaves the party with this incredibly tense reality. There is an invincible, regenerating lapine monster stalking them.
And their basic instincts for survival just cannot be trusted to identify it.
Exactly.
So they have no choice but to pack up their ruined camp and follow its trail into these really ominous, dark trees ahead.
Right, into the woods.
But then, the threat of the troll rabbit abruptly vanishes. It absolutely refuses to enter this specific patch of woods.
It won't cross the tree line.
Yeah. And looking at the logs, I initially thought, oh, okay, they found a sanctuary. Because the oppressive darkness of the Land of Terror just lifts.
Well, it doesn't just lift, it is aggressively replaced.
Aggressively is the perfect word.
Yeah.
They step across the tree line, and suddenly the forest is drenched in this bright cinematic moonlight.
It's very jarring.
Birds are harmonizing in a choreographed chorus. Literal pixies flutter down from the branches and start braiding Princess Peach's mane with fresh lilies.
Right, which she probably loves.
Oh, she's thrilled. And they drop these little woven flower crowns onto all the characters' heads.
Even Tristan.
Yes. Tristan, the stoic, humorless knight, ends up with a herringbone braid trailing down his back.
It feels like they just walked into a nursery rhyme.
They've entered an area that the locals call the Forest of Bread.
Which sounds so cozy. It does. And sitting right in the center of this clearing is a literal gingerbread house, held up by candy cane posts, radiating the smell of cinnamon and brown sugar.
But this is where the narrative completely pulls the rug out from under us again.
Of course.
Because this isn't a natural, benevolent fey wonderland. When they knock on the gingerbread door, their caretaker who answers isn't like a cheerful baker.
No.
It's an ancient, twisted, weeping willow tree. And he is utterly, profoundly miserable.
He is so unhappy. And he explains the brutal mechanics of this environment. This entire aesthetic is basically the result of a curse cast by a heavily intoxicated wizard.
A drunk wizard.
Yeah.
Typical.
Right. The wizard was taking a joke from a local Lord Thomas, far too literally.
Okay.
The goal was to protect the area from trolls. And since trolls naturally despise joy and happiness,
the wizard simply cast an overwhelming, suffocating, cute spell over the entire forest.
Exactly.
It's literally a pest control mechanism.
That is exactly what it is. And it worked flawlessly. The trolls won't go near the place.
Hence the rabbit staying outside.
Right. But it also trapped this poor weeping willow tree. A being whose very biological and magical nature is to be gleamy, droopy, and sad inside a prison of eternal, inescapable joy.
Oh, man, the psychological toll of that is just staggering.
It's horrifying.
We actually get to see the adjusting magic of this curse in action, and it is horrifying.
Yeah, the paintings.
Yes. So the inside of the gingerbread house is decorated with these marshmallow chairs and these sappy, overly sweet paintings of baby seals.
Very kitschy.
Super kitschy.
Yeah.
And the willow tree, who is just completely fed up with his existence, swipes his wooden fingers across one of the canvases and tears a huge gash right through a baby seal.
It just destroys it.
But the canvas instantly knits itself back together. It heals.
And the tree provides the crucial warning here. If you damage the house or the decorations, they don't just repair themselves. They grow back cuter.
Okay, wait, stop right there. Because this changes the entire dynamic of the magic system.
It does.
If I'm understanding this correctly, it's not just a static illusion. It is a reactive, punitive system.
Yes, exactly.
It's like being trapped in a children's television show where you aren't allowed to be sad. Or like a social media algorithm that enforces toxic positivity.
That's a great way to put it.
If you show a single negative emotion, or if you act out in frustration, the environment punishes you by forcing an even more aggressive, saccharine cheerfulness onto your screen. It just isolates you.
That is a phenomenal analogy. The magic system isolates the individual by utterly refusing to acknowledge their internal reality.
Right.
Because in most classic storytelling, the safe haven, you know, the cozy inn, the hidden elven valley, is a place where characters go to process their trauma.
Right. They rest and heal.
The environment is soothing, allowing them to lower their shields and deal with their emotional baggage.
But not here.
No. Here, the author uses profound environmental irony. The physically safest place in the forest is actually the most emotionally hostile environment imaginable.
And to really drive that point home, the author places one of the most painful, bitter character interactions right in the middle of it.
Oh, the fight.
Yes. Just put yourself in Lady Hannah's shoes for a minute. You are standing outside a gingerbread house, birds are chirping, pixies are buzzing around your head.
Everything is excessively happy.
Right. And you finally have to confront the man you have feelings for about a rumor that is just breaking your heart.
The argument between Hannah and Tristan is brutal.
It is. She has been hearing whispers from everyone else in their circles that Tristan is romantically involved with a woman named Lady Madeline.
Right.
Hannah feels completely humiliated that she is the last to know, and she finally confronts him. And Tristan's response, it's like ice.
He gives her nothing.
He doesn't soften his tone. He doesn't offer any empathy or like comfort for her embarrassment. He just stares at her with a completely blank expression and flatly denies it.
He repeats 3 times that there is no romance.
Almost challenging her.
Yeah.
Essentially asking, do you think me a liar?
Right. And the environmental irony we discussed really peaks in this scene.
Totally.
Why place this heavy, devastating romantic confrontation here of all places?
Right.
Because having a deeply real, profoundly painful human conflict play out against a backdrop of artificial mandatory joy heightens the emotional stakes of the scene so much.
It really does.
The environment isn't reflecting their sadness. It is actively marking it. The curse of cuteness forces the bitterness of their reality into really sharp relief.
You can just picture Tristan standing there in the moonlight, hands clenched into fists, utterly silent and furious.
With a herringbone braid in his hair.
Yes. With flower petals drifting past his face. It is brilliant writing.
It is.
But of course, the psychological torture of the Forest of Bread can't last. The next morning, the party packs up and crosses the boundary out of the cursed woods.
And the transition back to reality is incredibly violent.
Oh, it's instant.
The illusion drops the millisecond they cross the tree line.
Right.
Princess Peaches, who is practically prancing because of her perfectly groomed, lily-braided mane, is instantly covered in mud, sweat, and grime.
Her perceived beauty was entirely dependent on the toxic positivity of the forest.
Exactly.
But the real shock comes from minstrel Sam.
Oh, Sam.
Sam had decided to pilfer one of those cute baby seal paintings from the gingerbread house, strapping the canvas to his back.
Because why not?
Right. But the second they step out of the fae magic, the painting reverts to its true form. The baby seal vanishes.
And what replaces it is awful.
In its place is a wet, gory, screaming image of 2 rotting hellhounds tearing apart a severed head.
It's so dark.
And when Sam frantically tries to scratch the canvas to get it off, the painting actually bleeds all over his hands. And it screams.
It's a visceral reminder to the listener that the Land of Terror is fundamentally brutal.
Yeah.
The fae cuteness was nothing more than a localized anesthetic. Now the numbness is worn off, and they are standing in this bleak, dusty wasteland of dead brush and jagged canyons.
And they have to rely on civilization now.
Right.
Because they're approaching the borders of the goblin territory known as Greedle.
Yes.
And this is where the narrative tackles its third major subversion. When you hear goblin territory, the genre has trained you to expect certain things.
Feral howling in the distance.
Right. Crude spikes lining the road, skulls on pikes.
Exactly.
But as our fae party walks down this dusty road, they aren't greeted by war drums, they're greeted by corporate marketing.
It's hilarious. The logs describe these bizarre roadside signs carved into boulders and wooden posts.
Reading like, "Are you tired?"
Right? No need to whine.
"No need to needle."
Welcome to Greedle.
It reads exactly like a highway billboard campaign for a roadside tourist trap.
It really does.
And when they finally reach the choke point, which is a toll bridge spanning a raging river,
Yeah.
we get our first look at the actual goblin horde.
Except it's not a horde.
No, it's two goblin guards. And they aren't sharpening rusty blades or threatening to boil the travelers alive.
No, they're having a debate.
A deeply heated, pedantic culinary debate about whether quiche is an acceptable dish if you use sufficiently stinky cheese and rotten spinach.
They're essentially acting as food critics,
Yes.
but their criteria for what makes food good is entirely inverted.
Exactly. So when Hannah steps up to the toll bridge, she doesn't draw her sword to fight her way across. She enters a negotiation.
Right.
The goblins demand a toll, but they aren't interested in shiny gold coins. They want something with character, meaning something moldy or foul.
Which is such a great detail.
And here's a detail that completely fascinated me. Hannah presents an official summons letter sent on behalf of a goblin princess named Griselda. Doesn't inspect the royal seal. He doesn't read the calligraphy.
No.
He leans in, takes a deep sniff of the parchment, and says, "Yep, that's Princess Griselda's scent. All right, you can pass."
That specific sensory detail does so much heavy lifting for the world building.
It really does.
Because it establishes that their entire bureaucratic system relies on olfactory verification rather than visual or written proof.
It makes sense for goblins. Tristan ends up securing their passage by bribing the guards with a loaf of fresh bread, though he has to profusely apologize that the bread isn't moldy yet.
Right, he has to excuse the freshness.
But before they cross into the city proper, Minstrel Sam gives the party a crash course in goblin culture. And it really reframes everything we just saw.
Sam breaks down goblin economics, which basically operates on a system of aggressive haggling and inverted perceived value.
Yeah. He explains that giving a goblin terrible, rotting food is actually a massive compliment to their refined palate.
Right.
But more importantly, he explains the social contract of commerce here. You have to haggle.
It's mandatory.
If you just accept a goblin's first price without complaining bitterly about how much it costs, the goblin becomes deeply suspicious. They view a smooth, fair trade as an insult.
The conflict is the point of the transaction.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, if you aren't fighting them on the price, you aren't respecting them as merchants.
So I have to ask, are these goblins actually monsters in the traditional sense?
That's the question, isn't it?
Because as I read these logs, I don't see a horde of evil creatures. I see extreme Wall Street day traders who just happen to have terrible hygiene.
That's a very fair assessment.
When the party finally enters the city of Greedle, it is an architectural marvel. It's a massive, terraced city carved directly into the canyon walls, complete with a royal palace.
It's civilized.
And they aren't attacked by berserkers. They are immediately swarmed by aggressive street vendors.
You have goblins shouting at them to visit the magic mud pits or, aggressively pushing premium cabbage leaves that are prized because they're covered in the juiciest caterpillars.
Gross, but very on brand.
Very.
And then there's Skunky Merc.
Ah, skunky.
Skunky is a professional toady, which is a goblin who charges a premium to walk in front of you and clear a path through the crowd by shouting at people.
A very necessary service in Greedle.
Apparently.
Yeah.
And he demands a daily retainer of 5 greaseballs, which is the local fiat currency. The entire threat model has just shifted.
It has. What the author is doing here is humanizing the perceived monsters, but crucially, not by making them look or act like humans.
Right.
The narrative humanizes them through the sheer weight of their bureaucracy and commerce.
That makes a lot of sense.
By giving the goblins these intricate, unbreakable social rules, like the requirement to complain during a sale or verifying royal decrees by scent, it transforms them from generic disposable sword fodder into a rich, lived-in society.
Right.
They have an economy, they have infrastructure, they have service industries.
It replaces the primal fear of physical violence with the exhausting frustration of high-pressure sales tactics.
Exactly.
Which, if you think about a stoic, noble warrior like Sir Tristan, is probably a much worse fate.
Oh, it's his nightmare.
He knows exactly how to fight a fire-breathing dragon. But he has absolutely no defense against a professional toady demanding greaseballs.
It renders his entire skill set completely useless, and that is the ultimate subversion of the hero's journey.
It really is.
Mm.
So as we pull back and look at the entirety of these narrative logs, the genius of this story becomes incredibly clear.
Yeah.
This narrative succeeds because it fundamentally refuses to play by the rules of the genre it occupies.
It sets up the tropes, you know, by heart, and then it just violently pivots.
Exactly. It gives you a cute pink bunny, and then uses that cuteness to bypass your threat response before caving your chest in.
Yep.
It gives you a fairy tale forest of singing birds and turns it into a psychological prison that punishes anything less than absolute toxic joy.
Right.
And it gives you a goblin horde that doesn't want to drink your blood. They just want to charge you an exorbitant toll, sell you some rotten spinach,
yeah,
and force you to haggle for their professional toadying services.
It proves that the most memorable storytelling doesn't come from fulfilling expectations.
No.
It comes from understanding the expectations so intimately that you know exactly where to break them to cause the maximum amount of friction for your audience.
I love that. Maximum amount of friction.
Yeah.
And that is exactly why this matters to you listening right now.
It's very applicable.
You don't have to be navigating the land of terror to apply this. Think about your own life. Whether you are pitching a new initiative in a boardroom, designing a presentation, or just trying to capture someone's attention at a dinner party.
If you follow the standard recipe, people's brains will categorize your message as safe and they will just tune out.
Exactly. But if you take the predictable and twist it, if you hand them a fluffy bunny that suddenly explodes with new information, you short-circuit their automatic filtering.
That is how you make your message unforgettable.
You have to disrupt the pattern.
You have to force them to process the information anew rather than relying on their preconceived categories.
Exactly. So before we sign off, I want to leave you with a thought experiment to mull over today.
Oh, good.
Think back to that drunk wizard's cute spell in the Forest of Bread. It was a localized environment that successfully kept out dangerous elements by being forcefully, aggressively cheerful.
Right.
What is the real-world equivalent of the Forest of Bread?
That's a great question.
Look around your workplace, your social circles, or your digital spaces. What overly sanitized, forcefully positive environments are actually designed, whether intentionally or not, to keep certain kinds of people or certain kinds of hard, necessary truths out?
Because sometimes the most dangerous environments aren't the ones filled with monsters.
No, they aren't. They are the brightly lit rooms where you aren't allowed to complain. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.